funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does your brain grow and change over time, and to what extent will it dictate the course of your life? As my guest today will tell us, the brains we are born with determine what we think and do and what we don't or can't do. And so the study of how they develop, work, and occasionally malfunction is, in his words, part of a quest to find ourselves. D.F. Swab is professor of neurobiology at the University of Amsterdam and head of the neuropsychiatric disorders research team at the Netherlands Institute for Neuroscience. His book is called We Are Our Brains, a neurobiography of the brain from the womb to Alzheimer's. He joins us today as part of KERA's Breakthroughs Initiative. Dick Franz, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What is the relationship between this organ we call the brain and the mind?
The mind is just the activity of the brain. That's all. So there is not a brain and a mind. The mind is the active brain.
And as it turns out, human brains are astonishingly efficient and complex computers that contain our entire lives.
Yes, our potentials, but also our limitations. It is programmed in many ways, even before we leave the womb.
They begin to serve us, as you say, long before we have any conscious memories, so that it's an interaction between the brain of a fetus and the brain of the mother that dictates the moment even that something like labor begins.
Yes, the fetus is, in fact, determining that moment, because the fetus is growing and growing, and the mother can only deliver some 18 to 15% of her metabolism to the fetus. And the fetus notices that it gets not enough food anymore when it becomes too big, and that is the sign to start labor from the fetal side. And the mother is determining the hour of birth, preferentially, of course, in the quiet period of the night.
I was fascinated to read about the relationships between difficult births and later developmental brain disorders, including some that won't manifest themselves for years to come. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, for instance, it was well known for schizophrenia that birth was often very difficult. And it was thought some time ago that because of the difficult labor and the lack of oxygen, the brain of the child might have been damaged and schizophrenia was the result. But we know now that schizophrenia is caused for more than 80% by genetic factors and for the rest by early developmental factors in the womb. So schizophrenia is already there at the moment labor starts. And in fact, it's the difficult labor is the first sign that there's something wrong with brain development of the child. Mm-hmm. So it's the first symptom rather than the cause of schizophrenia. And then only later in puberty, when the brain is changing in its function by sex hormones, the first symptoms of schizophrenia appear. But the disease has been there always.
Are we at a place yet where we could use the information that a child was born following a difficult labor? And we want to stress that obviously not every difficult labor results in a child with any kind of developmental disorder. But could we?
No, certainly not. But it is a reason to follow the child carefully.
Yeah. Is there anything we can do to prevent the onset of these diseases?
Like schizophrenia? No. It's there's a multi-genetic component involved. It's not a one-gene type of disease that can be found easily, so you cannot prevent that. And, well, in fact, you cannot prevent quite a number of problems because brain development is so complex that it's no wonder that in a certain percentage the child has just bad luck, and it's not developing in the right way.
How does pregnancy change the brains of expectant mothers?
Well, it prepares the mother for taking care of the child, so it is inducing kind of nesting behavior. Mothers are starting to make the room for the child. But it's also influencing the father's brain.
How do fathers change?
The testosterone levels of the father diminish. That means they become less aggressive and more caring, which might be useful in that circumstances.
And I suppose if the father's brain is changing, it must be in response to something that's going on in the mother's body?
Yes, and we think it's a sign of what we call pheromones, and those are compounds that are excreted in the sweat and the urine of the mother. And in fact, they are signing to the olfactory system through the smell, but the father doesn't consciously smell it. Those compounds only have an unconscious effect on the brain. Hmm.
Do those changes last the rest of our lives? It occurred to me after I had children that I couldn't tune out background noise the way I could when I was younger. And I think that's because as a mother, I had to be very aware of a noise from the other room that my baby might need help. Will that stay with me forever?
Well, I said once to my wife that the umbilical cord can be stretched even over the ocean. And it's never cut, because when our son was working in America and we were in Europe, she was worrying every day about him. So I am afraid it will never change.
Not necessarily a bad thing.
No, it has advantages, but it can be terribly difficult too. Always worrying every noise in the environment is related to what might have happened to the child. Mm.
You know, we're worried particularly in this country right now about childhood obesity and adult obesity and the causes of that, and we've looked at our environment. What have we learned about things that can happen in utero that might predispose us to obesity?
Well, there are in fact two factors that might predispose people to obesity. In the first place, if there is not enough food in the environment, and then the fetal brain is organized in such a way that every calorie is kept in the body of the child. And then when it comes in a world with normal amount of food, it keeps all the calories and it's prone to become obese. And we know this from the hunger winter in the Netherlands, where during the last phase of the German occupation, there was no food, and the children were born too light, but later they were prone to become obese. You can say, well, this problem is finished, of course, enough food in the environment, look around, all those fat people, but in fact, there are quite a number of children still born with a too low birth weight because the placenta of the mother doesn't work well. And those children have also a risk to become obese for the same reason. So the brain is set in such a way that all the food is kept in the body. And a second problem, and that is rather new, is that if the mother is obese, then the child in the womb is also programmed in such a way that he might become obese later. So those are the two factors, too much food and too little food. Both result in obesity.
You were actually born after that hunger winter, but you write that your mother had friends who were able to help her get enough nutrition.
I was born during the hunger winter.
During a hunger winter, okay.
Yeah.
Did you grow up noticing, you know, that your classmates had a sort of strange relationship to food?
No.
This is something
I must say that when I was growing up in that period, there was not an enormous amount of food in Europe. It was still, we were very careful with food. And, so there was not an overproduction as it is now.
How does gender identity begin to form in the womb as we're developing, physiologically we're developing sex organs, but our brain is also developing a sense of who we are?
Yes, of course our sex organs are developing quite early, in the first few months of pregnancy. And our brain is sexually differentiating in the male or female direction during the second half of pregnancy. And this is due to the presence of testosterone, which pushes the fetal brain into the male direction, or a lack of testosterone, and that causes a female development of the brain. And it's already visible in the chemical way, halfway gestation, that the male and the female brain are different.
Is it possible that we could predict early in a child's life through some kind of brain test whether that child will be gay or straight?
No, there is no way at this moment to determine whether a child will become gay or straight. No, there's not. So we have just to wait and see what the behavior is telling us.
But your sense is that this really is something that happens long before we are born, or before we're born, rather than any kind of choice that individuals might make later in life.
Yes, yes. It's a mistake of some people that they think that homosexuality is a choice. Some people have even called it a political choice, and the churches have called it a wrong choice, but it's not a choice at all. It's broken in the brain before birth.
How do early childhood environments promote or discourage healthy development of the brain?
Excuse me, I couldn't hear
the environments that we live in and how much stimulation is around, how do they affect brain development in early childhood?
Well, it's essential that a child is growing up in a safe environment, in a warm environment, where the child is stimulated in order to get an optimal brain development. Mm-hmm. So this is crucial. And again, it's a matter of now or never. So if the child is neglected during early development, it's not possible to later catch up. And the brain of the child will remain smaller and less functional for the rest of its life.
Hmm. So I suppose ultimately intelligence is a function of early environment and whatever genetic legacy we've received from our parents?
Yes, it's, of course, brain development in general is an interaction between the genetic factors and the environmental factors from the very beginning onwards. But for intelligence measured as IQ, more than 80% is determined by the genetic factors. So it's very important to choose your parents.
And for those of us who can't do that, I suppose we can just try to make sure that later in life, maybe it's too late to have the same benefits as early in life, but we should continue trying to learn new skills throughout our lives?
Yes, of course. And it's even important until the last part of our life to be very active. New things are very important to stimulate the brain. And people that are active in old age have less risk for Alzheimer's.
D.F. Swab is my guest. He's professor of neurobiology at the University of Amsterdam and head of the neuropsychiatric disorders research team at the Netherlands Institute for Neuroscience. We're talking about his new book, which is called We Are Our Brains, a neurobiography of the brain from the womb to Alzheimer's. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us now at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with neurobiologist D.F. Swab. His new book is called We Are Our Brains, a neurobiography of the brain from the womb to Alzheimer's. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Nick Franz, how does exposure to multiple languages early in life help to shape the brain and even protect it over the course of a lifetime?
Well, bilingual education is enormous stimulation for the brain. And in fact, there are several publications now showing that those children that were growing up bilingually have an risk for Alzheimer's disease only 4 years later than the rest of the population. Hmm. So it helps to stimulate the brain.
What is the work going on in a teenage brain that can make them so very challenging to deal with?
Yes, well, the sex hormones are going to circulate in teenagers. And if you ask the question, what brain regions are responsive to sex hormones, the answer is every brain region, from the rostral part until the spinal cord. Not all the brain cells, but every region in the brain has cells that are sensitive to sex hormones. So the children have to learn to deal with a totally different functioning brain. And this is, of course, challenging both for the children and the parents. But I always tell that it has also an evolutionary advantage, that terrible behavior of teenagers, because they become reproductive during that age, and they should not reproduce in the same environment as the parents, because then you get an accumulation of little mistakes on DNA, mm-hmm. of mutations. And what can protect this problem is that the children hate their parents, they want to go away, they only think on short term, never on long term, in a long term way. And they want the adventure, they want a new environment, and this prevents them from reproducing in the same environment. So it has an evolutionary advantage.
We've heard recently that the prefrontal cortex is not fully developed until about the age of 25. Do you agree with that research?
Yes, that's right, mm-hmm. yes. And that means that although the law thinks that we are mature at the age of 18, that we in fact are only mature at the age of 25. And that has consequences, of course, for punishment of children between, let's say, 16 and 26.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because we all feel mature at 20 or 21, and then years later we can look back at our behavior after that time and recognize that it did take a bit longer.
Yes, it might take until you are 60.
How is love like addiction to a drug?
Well, love is giving an enormous reward in the same brain region as addictive compounds give a reward. And that also means that if the love is finished, you get a kind of reaction that is equal to that found after finishing drugs.
Hmm. Almost like a withdrawal.
Withdrawal, mm-hmm. yes, a withdrawal, mm-hmm. yeah.
Of course, it changes over time. Is that? I mean, do we become resistant to the appeal of that? Even people who stay in love for years say it doesn't feel quite the same as it did in those heady first few months.
Yeah, it's in the first place amazing that partner choice, that is so important for the rest of your life, is decided by the brain in an unconscious way. Hmm. So many factors are taken into account, but the decision to fall in love is made in an unconscious way. You just fall in love, and you can't help to fall in love. And the brain is changing in its action in many brain areas during that period. Only after, let's say, 1 year, the information comes to the cortex, so you become aware of the choice, which might be a deception for some people, of course. But also the stress hormones are going down after 1 year. It feels different, yes.
So our brains fall in love for us, is essentially what you're saying.
Well, there is no difference between our brains and us. We are our brains.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Lee in Fort Worth. Hello, Lee.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Fascinating discussion. You talked earlier about low birth weight babies who did not have enough food in utero, and I was wondering is there a birth weight cutoff that causes this reaction to hold on to food?
Well, the cause is often that the placenta doesn't work efficiently, so the child does not get enough food. Doesn't pass the placenta efficiently, although food is present. Hmm. And that means that the child is noticing that there's not enough food in the environment. And then the brain of the child is taking its precautions for the moment it will leave the womb and setting all the systems in the hypothalamus in such a way that all the calories are kept in the body.
What have we learned about addiction to drugs other than love, things like alcohol and heroin and cocaine, why some people can use and even abuse them without becoming addicted and others become addicted very easily?
Well, the first thing is that all those addictive compounds are compounds that are also produced by the brain or sensed by the brain. So the brain is producing opiates, and the brain is responding to compounds that are similar to alcohol. So the compounds are acting in existing neurotransmitter systems in the brain. And since they are acting in those systems, they also change the endogenous production of the neurotransmitters, of the chemical messengers in the brain. And the longer you use those compounds, the more you use, the more the brain is changed in the production of its chemical messengers. Well, the sensitivity to addiction is determined again by the genetic background of people. So some people are less sensitive to addictive compounds, or because they are also less sensitive to a certain chemical in the brain. And then you need more in order to feel the reward that you normally feel. And this might be a reason to take drugs, just to get the reward that you otherwise don't get.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Sarah in Dallas. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Well, thank you, Chris, for having Dr. Swab on. It's a very interesting show today. I have a couple of questions. One is, you all mentioned about the bilingual brain. I recently read an article about bilingual brain and the benefits and what happens, and I believe it's in Time magazine. And it just basically said bilingual brains, the advantage they have, they get really good at spatial reasoning because they're having to go back and forth to each language. But it didn't mention anything about actually exercising the memory muscle. And I believe there's something to be said for that. And my other point is the autistic brain, what's the latest research? I talked to one doctor because we have autistic children in my family. And a doctor told me that he thought it was, they believe it's too many brain cells. And I want to know what is the latest research on the autistic brain.
All right, let's see if we can get some answers for you. Thanks, Sarah.
Well, autism is for a main part caused by genetic factors. And the genetic factors are involved in brain development. They lead to a different brain, which indeed is forming more brain cells until the age of 4, and then the brain becomes smaller than the age of than the children of the same age. So there is a period in which autistic brain is indeed large, as you said. It often runs in families, not in a very easily detectable way, but there are genetic factors involved. Your first point was the bilingual brain. The second language change?
Mm-hmm. And spatial relations. Excuse me for interrupting. She was saying that bilingual brains are better at that.
Well, I think in many functions it will give a change. And the spatial functions are interesting because that has to do with the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is one of the brain areas that is affected very early in Alzheimer's disease. So if you stimulate that structure, then you are prone to have Alzheimer's disease later. And that's indeed the case.
What role does brain development play in our tendency to be more or less or not at all religious during our lives?
Well, it's all about variability, and we are variable in all our functions, also in what we call spirituality. So the sensitivity for something that is not measurable, that is high up, that some people call God or whatever. And then if you are very spiritual, you fill it in with the local religion. The environment is filling in the spirituality of the child. And some children are so spiritual that they keep religious for the rest of their life, and others are less less spiritual and they can stop believing.
Well, you mentioned the fact that, I mean, obviously religion exists in cultures in every part of the world, and yet no young child is born knowing about religion. It's something that they have passed on to them by the people around them who are raising them. So what would the evolutionary purpose be of a belief in a higher power?
Well, I think that the main purpose is to keep the group together. So you have something in common that also asks for some rituals and a kind of dressing that makes visible that you belong to the group. And when you belong to a group, you are stronger. It's easier to resist other groups. So that seems to be the main evolutionary advantage of religion.
How different are male and female brains?
Very different. Although there is overlap in some functions, other functions there's no overlap at all. Let's say the menstrual cycle is regulated by the brain, only in females, not in males. So that's 100% difference. And there are other functions which have an overlap. But in hundreds of brain areas and thousands of studies, it has been shown that there are differences. For instance, the connectivity between left and right is more pronounced in women than in men, except for the small brain, the cerebellum, in which the connectivity between left and right is more pronounced in men. And that might explain that men are better in, let's say, in some sports, and women are better in what we call female intuition, so putting together different pieces of information to a whole that asks also for connectivity.
And I suppose the fact that we have two different kinds of brains on average, and of course we're speaking in generalities here, I suppose that's good for us as a society of human beings. Do we complement each other's strengths and weaknesses?
Yes, that is the general idea behind it. So men are better in spatial tasks, which was necessary for the yard, and women are better in social tasks, also in language, which is better, of course, for their social environment that was necessary to bring up the children. So this type of division of labor was present and was useful in evolution.
We have an email here from Tom in Dallas who writes, can you shed light on the fact that a high point of exceptional intellectual creativity is generally seen at an earlier age in some areas of endeavor and a later age in other areas?
Well, functions need different, different functions need different brain areas. And each brain area has a history of development which is different from other brain areas. So if you look to functions, they mature in a differential way.
How can we protect our brains from deterioration as we age?
Well, in the first place, again, by choosing the right parents, because there is a very important genetic factor for healthy aging. So in some families, people become very old in a healthy way with a very well-functioning brain, and this is determined by genetic factors. But then it's a matter of stimulation during early development, which gives a reserve for the old age. And I told you already about bilingual stimulation, but there's also stimulation by an interesting job, by novelty, also novelty in older age. And this determines whether at what age you will get Alzheimer's disease. Ultimately, we will all get Alzheimer's disease. But of course, many of us die from a heart attack or from cancer before that.
So the reason we have seen rising rates of Alzheimer's is that we are living longer generally?
Yes, there's an exponential increase with age. So if people, if more people become old, as is now the case in the West, then more people will get Alzheimer's disease. And since women are becoming quite some years older than men, there is a higher prevalence in women than in men.
We're speaking this hour with D.F. Swaab, who's professor of neurobiology at the University of Amsterdam and head of the neuropsychiatric disorders research team at the Netherlands Institute for Neuroscience. His book is called We Are Our Brains, a neurobiography of the brain from the womb to Alzheimer's. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with D.F. Swaab, professor of neurobiology at the University of Amsterdam and author of the book We Are Our Brains, a neurobiography of the brain from the womb to Alzheimer's. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So one of the questions that we have been trying to solve for a long time, whether it's through science or through art and philosophy, is whether or not human beings have free will. What's your perspective on that question?
Well, I think that free will is a very nice illusion. So we think we have free will, but in fact our decisions are determined by the way our brain is formed during development. And we make the decisions in an unconscious way, and only after we have made the decision, it becomes conscious. So we get the idea that we made the decision in a conscious way, but this is just an illusion.
So what does that suggest about ways that we might better reward achievements and things we think of as positive and punish crimes and behaviors that we consider negative?
Yeah, well, in both cases, it's very much dependent on the way the brain has been formed during development. And but even if we don't have free will, then we should make clear that people should keep to the law, to the rules in society, because every society needs rules in order to function. If you see a monkey society, then the young monkeys learn the rules because an old monkey is giving a hit when he doesn't obey to the rules. And we have given this power to the police and to justice.
Mm-hmm.
But we want them to make clear to people that they have to keep to the rules. And if justice wouldn't do that, then society would do it by itself. So we need punishment in order to make clear to people that they should keep to the rules. The question is, of course, whether we punish in the best way. And the answer is no.
So there might be ways that we could effectively and truly rehabilitate violent offenders rather than simply doling out a punishment that is unpleasant.
Yes. If you have a look in prison, then it's amazing that the majority of people in prison have psychiatric disorders that are not treated. They are punished, but they are not treated. So this is the first point, that we should not only punish people, but also see whether they need treatment. And then prison is, of course, a very bad way to punish, because people are, that get into prison at young age, their schooling is stopped, their education is stopped. The only thing they learn in prison is criminality. So when they come back in society, they can't do anything else but go back into criminality. There's a lot to be changed in that sense.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jim in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Hello. My question is about brain plasticity. I suffered a stroke about a year ago. I discovered that when I, as my brain was rebuilding, it killed part of the brain, went to parties, and after each party, I slept very, very deeply. And I got better the next day in successive steps. So having said that, if somebody undertook a brain-intensive study, say a foreign language, really foreign language like Russian or Greek, that would they undergo benefits by sleeping so deeply?
Thanks for your call.
Yes, brain plasticity is, of course, an important topic. The point is that the brain is not so plastic as we would like it to be, because then, of course, you would just recover from a lesion in the brain, from a brain infarction. And it's very difficult to get all the functions back. Sleep is important, normal sleep, but also exercise. Depending on the place where the lesion is, one should stimulate the environment of the lesion in order to take functions over. But the plasticity is limited, and the success is therefore also limited.
Speaking of exercise, we have heard a lot recently about the benefits to our brains of exercising our bodies. What have you learned about the research into that, the effectiveness of that?
Well, it's often said that sport is healthy, but then we also know that contact sports like soccer or rugby or whatever give a lot of brain damage. So there are a lot of sports that give more damage than they stimulate the brain. Hmm. The best sport is, I think, playing chess. That is directly stimulating the brain and not causing any damage. And if you look to people that regularly play chess, they get Alzheimer's disease on a later age. So I think one should be careful with saying that sports is so healthy. If you do sports, then be careful that you don't hit the brain.
If there is a causal relationship between an activity like playing chess and a delay in the onset of Alzheimer's disease, is it possible to say that performing that activity is what prevents the Alzheimer's disease, or that a later onset of disease for some other reason maybe allows people to play something like chess earlier in their lives?
Yeah, I think it's both.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, there has been a study in Chicago on the brains of nuns that showed that the nuns that were active during the last phase of their life had less Alzheimer changes than the ones that just were sitting on the couch. But then the investigators went to the letters they were writing to their family at the age of 20, and they analyzed the sentences, and the sentences were more complex in those nuns that were active during the last phase of their life than in those nuns that were inactive. So they had a better brain from the start onwards. But there are also experiments showing that if you stimulate the brain in a differential way by novelty at old age, that you can perform psychological tests in a better way. So it's both. It's, again, the background in genetics and early development and the stimulation in old age.
We have an email here from Tinker who wants to know, what explains personality change that can happen after electroshock therapy? And actually, this is a tweet.
Well, electroshock therapy, if it is given many times, then it might cause some brain damage, and brain damage can cause personality change. But it, the change most often seen is memory disorders after electroshocks. This said, it must also be said that it's a very effective therapy if nothing else is helping to come out of a depression.
Can you talk about why it is so challenging often for patients dealing with depression or a number of other psychiatric illnesses to find an effective medication, that why one drug works so well for one patient and not at all for another?
Yeah. So for depression, we know that there are very different causes in terms of brain systems that are affected in depression. They all lead to depression, but different people have different weak systems in their brain on the basis of genetics and early development again. So the end point is depression, but the cause is different. And that means that it should also be treated in a different way. And we hope that ultimately we can find out what the most efficient therapy is for different people. So make it more tailor-made for each patient.
Let's go to the phone now. We have Karen on the line in Dallas. Hello, Karen.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. When you were discussing sports, it came to mind that I've started getting more practice of yoga, and I wondered if you had any knowledge of the impact of yoga on the brain. I mean, I'm concerned about being older and preventing Alzheimer's and getting more cardiovascular, but I really enjoyed the yoga and wondered what you thought of that.
Well, it's not bad. What yoga is doing is that you learn to change the activity from one brain area to another brain area. And this causes a relaxation and also a diminishment of stress hormones and an increase during the night of melatonin, which is a sleeping hormone. So you learn to change the activity of the brain by meditation. And that's certainly not dangerous.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Christina in Plano. Hi, Christina.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I love your show, Chris.
Thank you.
I listen to it every day.
Thank you.
My question is practically simple. What activities can we do with the people that are in their lives with Alzheimer's that will stimulate their brain and wake them up, maybe not, but just keep them going?
Any thoughts on that, Dick Franz?
Yes. What is very important in the last phase of life and in Alzheimer's disease is that that the circadian rhythm, day-night rhythm of the brain, is disturbed in the early phase. And that makes that people are very restless during the night. They sleep in little periods with waking in between, and they might leave their bed, they might even leave their house. They put things on the fire, etc. And in daytime, they also sleep in a fragmented way. And we found that if you give more light in the environment, then you can restore day and night rhythm and even get some improvement in psychological testing. So it's important to expose people in Alzheimer's in early phase to more light. And you can put that more light in the ceiling, but you can also bring people outside. And that gives more light than you can ever bring into the house. So light is a very simple way to get the day-night rhythm back, to diminish the nightly restlessness, to diminish the depressive mood of Alzheimer's patients. And it's something that is not known broadly at this moment.
What role does the brain play in our experience of near-death experiences, in the fact that some people have these things and feel them to be very real?
Yeah. Well, the near-death experience is a real experience, but it has a couple of characteristics. In the first place, you can see a tunnel, which is due to the fact that the retina of the eye has a lack of oxygen, lack of blood. And this starts at the periphery of the eye. That means that the periphery becomes black and the central part is still light. So that's the tunnel with light at the end. And there's a brain area that's very sensitive to a lack of oxygen, which is the area that gets information from the muscles, from the joints, also from the inner ear and from the visual system, and is combining this information and gives us the place of our body in space. And if this brain area is not functioning well, you get the idea that you are floating, that you are floating out of your body, which is not the case. Nothing is happening, but this is just because the brain is not functioning well. And so all the symptoms of near-death experience can be explained by bad function of brain areas, and there's nothing magical about it. But people that experience this have the idea that they were there in heaven and returned, and they might become very religious because of this.
D.F. Swab is professor of neurobiology at the University of Amsterdam and head of the neuropsychiatric disorders research team at the Netherlands Institute for Neuroscience. His new book is We Are Our Brains, a neurobiography of the brain from the womb to Alzheimer's. He joined us today as part of KERA's Breakthroughs Initiative. Dick Franz, it's been a very interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. We had help on the phones today from Katie Daniel. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show anytime via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.